be bold and be brave and just go for it.
As photographers, we are always looking for powerful images that will hold time and place, that will draw people in and symbolize something universal, something shared, something emotional.
Everybody needs to see what's going on everywhere. Pictures just stand out. This is how we remember.
Insights, kits, and the conversations that matter with the world's leading photographers and filmmakers in Shutter Stories.
Photographing people for a living is both a thrill and an honor, but it also presents many challenges, whether photographing a sensitive moment, putting your subject at ease, or finding creative new ways to shoot portraits. Hello and welcome to Shutter Stories. My name is Ilvi Niokikchin. I'm a photojournalist and a Canon ambassador. In the last episode, I handed over to Martin Bissig, who talked to a number of fellow photographers about sports, about wildlife, and of course, how they use the Canon EOS R system. And this week, I'm back and I'm joined by three guests who know all about the challenges of photographing people and the difference that using the right kit can make. Helen Bartlett is a British family photographer who's always keen to share advice on how to get creative with different techniques and kit. James Musselwhite is a portrait photographer of more than 15 years with a wealth of knowledge and experience in the genre, and he's also based in the UK. And Laura El Tantawi is a British-Egyptian documentary photographer and visual artist based in London and Cairo, and her work explores issues of identity. All three shoot with the Canon EOS R system kit, and today we're going to compare notes to find out what we all have in common, what we do differently, and how switching to the EOS R system has helped our work. Welcome to the show, Helen, James, and Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys, for being here. Really lovely. I'm really looking forward to this chat. First of all, I love chatting about photography, of course, but also a lot about the EOS R system. I'm really curious to know how it's been for you to switch to this system. But before we talk about the camera, let's talk about photography first. I'm a photojournalist, and when I work on a story, well, things just kind of happen in front of my lens, and I don't really set things up it's really documenting and not directing. And I'm curious, basically to all of you, actually, what that's like for you. Do you document what's happening in front of your lens, or is it more directing in some way? Well, let's start with you, Helen.
Thank you. Well, for me, it really depends from client to client. Some people want something that's a bit more formal, but most people want very natural images of their kids. That's why they come to me. But it also depends on the ages of the kids, because if you've got a couple of teenagers, they're going to need a bit more direction than a two-year-old that's just going to sort of run around and do their thing and totally forget about the camera. So I'd say for me, on average, it's about 20% directing, but it's more about reacting. And the directing can be very subtle. So if we go to the park and I see some really nice light, I might kick the football in that direction so the game is played there, or suggest we go and hunt for the gruffalo in the really pretty area where there aren't loads of people. So I'll sort of subtly direct the action or direct the play to ensure I'm in a position where I'm in the best place to get pictures. And then I tend to let the action unfold in front of me, because the kids will always come up with stuff that's much better than I can think of myself. And, you know, that's when the real moments and the real personalities of the children shine through.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's what you're looking for, of course. I love that, how you're not directing, but kind of making real life better or better.
Making the best of the situations. I work in people's homes and I work in public parks. So I've always got to have an eye for not getting other people in the background or not getting the sort of detritus of everyday life. You know, people don't want a nappy bag or a packet of cigarettes in the back of their pictures. So, you know, which can be hilarious in teenagers' bedrooms. You're like, I'll just move that. And it's good fun.
Yeah, I can imagine. You want it to look nice but real. So that's it's quite a balance. Yeah, I can imagine. So what is that like for you, James?
I think, with the studio portraits, there's a sense of structure to it that we try to deviate from as much as possible. We try and take our clients through a consultation process that builds up a picture of who they are, particularly with families, and what different roles the children especially play within the family. And I think from the point of consultation to the to the actual shoot itself in the beginning of the shoot, it can seem quite structured. But then when they come into the studio, it's very free-form and it's very sort of, you know, a documentary style, I suppose. We'll often just notice little things that happen in the studio, little character traits that come across that then take the shoot in a completely different direction. So I think it's important to be as fluid as possible because that lends your style well to documenting personalities, documenting stories, and making photographs more personal to the clients that you're trying to shoot for.
That's beautiful. Yeah, and I also saw with your work that there's quite a diversity. Some images seem more posed than others, I would say.
I'd agree with that. It's just trying to tailor it to your client, because that's ultimately, you know, if you're shooting in a business, that's ultimately who you're trying to impress. You're trying to impress your client. I have to relinquish the reins sometimes because I'm such a control freak. I like to be in full control. That's why I shoot with strobes, because I want to control every aspect of the picture. But the real magic happens when I actually let that go a little bit and let the customer sort of take over a little bit, be a lot more observational in my style, and that's where you get the real magic shots.
Yeah. I agree. I recognize that as well in portraiture photography. And Laura, what's it like for you?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say 99% working in sort of the tradition of documentary, with the 1% being when I have to photograph a portrait. And I think in that sense, the portrait is really the one time where I do direct and I talk with the person I'm photographing about what direction I'd like them to look at, usually looking at some natural source of light that's occurring in the space we're in and trying to work with that light. But I think for me, I always even do that with a degree of discomfort, because what really excites me about photography is trying to control my surroundings through my camera, whereas obviously my surroundings are completely beyond my control, how people are moving, how the light is falling, how the cars are moving. So I think in that sense, I'm really excited by working in documentary, because the camera becomes the way I control the reality around me. And in portraiture, I feel a bit of discomfort actually trying to talk people into how I'd like them to pose or stand or the expression on their face. But it's always in line with what kind of story I'm trying to tell. And that's kind of the directing I'm trying to do in that sense. Work with some kind of emotion that really reflects the spirit of the story I'm telling in that case.
Yeah. I find that so difficult. I mean, coming from a documentary journalism background, I'm so used to just shooting what's in front of me. So when I'm taking portraits, well, especially a couple of years ago, I really had to get used to like asking people to show or to stand in a certain pose, because I wasn't used to direct in that way. But it's so important to that the portrait kind of matches the story you're trying to tell. But I really struggled with that for a long time. Do you recognize that? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you fall into all kinds of things of how you're showing people from a different culture or a different country or whatever. So you fall into all kinds of issues, yes, of representation. So there's a large degree of responsibility that even comes when you do get into the directing part with the documentary practice that we're engaged in. And it's something you always have to be thinking about, that you're not falling into these cliches and stereotypes. So yeah, I could see why there's, you know, a lot of discomfort to be doing it, because it's not easy.
No. And in your work, how much room is there for experimenting with creative techniques? I know you do a bit of that, quite a bit of that.
Well, I think I'm always really looking for ways to sort of rediscover new aspects of photography that are beyond things that I've already done, because I don't want to just keep sort of recreating, you know, the same visuals or the same work that I've done before. But of course, that has to, again, fall in line with whatever story I'm telling. So I can't just like go out and do slow shutter speeds for the sake of it if it doesn't really work with the story I'm trying to tell. So I'm always looking. And I think now also, and talking about the technologies we're going to be talking about today, looking at video and the use of audio and stuff and integrating them into the storytelling, this is a direction that I'm really excited about in my work. Mm. So I'm always looking to do new things as much as I can.
Yeah. Is that the same for Helen and James? Is there room to kind of experiment with creative techniques? I think I've been doing this for 15 years and I really recognize that I did a lot more of that in the first 5 years. So now that I'm thinking of these questions, I'm wondering, okay, maybe I need to start doing that more. And I guess now that I'm working with the new camera, it's a good moment. But yeah, tell me, yeah, what is that like for you?
I think that's really interesting what you were saying there about experimenting a lot when you first start out. I sometimes find if I look back at old shoots, I think, God, I was trying so many weird things. I mean, lots of them were crap, but I was really sort of trying a lot more and sort of, I think partly because I had more time, you know, that I wasn't so busy in my diary. I was able to sort of spend more time looking at things. But for me, I'm very lucky with my work. I work with a lot of repeat clients. So I see people year on year on year, which means I have to create something new while retaining the same style so the pictures fit together. Mm. But also I have this great level of trust with people. And, you know, I'm very happy to turn up and say, oh, you know, I've bought some weird kit. I've never used it before. I'm going to do a little bit of that at the end or try something new. And I have long shoots. I'm with people for usually at least 5 hours. So there's loads of time to try things, to play, to experiment. And clients love that. They're always like, oh, you've bought something fun, something new. Yeah. You know, how can we help you play with that? And it's a big sort of collaboration because each time, you know, if you see everyone year on year, you want to create something that they've never seen before while retaining your style. So I like to play and experiment. It's good fun.
Yeah, it is. It is. I agree.
I obviously get the safe shots first, though. Just
yes. Well, of course. Well, that's, yeah, I definitely also did. When I was experimenting more, I used to always start with just doing my shoot, finishing it, and then, like, yeah, doing some weirder shoots. Yeah. And for you, James?
Yeah, I mean, to Helen's point, I remember when the first studio I worked in, we got a ring flash on loan for a month, and every photographer in the studio couldn't stop using it, whether it was appropriate or not. It's just like when you get a new piece of kit, you've just got to try it on every client you got coming in. What we do in our studio, and this is really important, is that once a month we book a what we call a creative takeover shoot, which is completely trade for. So we'll do a model call out and with a theme, and we will hand pick the right model for us to work with for a day. So because it's on that basis, there's no expectation. So if the things that we're experimenting with go wrong, we haven't actually let anyone down. But it's really important to us, firstly, to have a creative outlet, but secondly, because photography is constantly evolving, to learn new skills and to create images and portraits with impact, because those pieces are the ones that get attention. Your customers and our customers don't, you know, 99% of them don't want that image, but it's the one that gets their attention. And I always want to have images up and in my studio that make customers go, wow, how did you do that? Mm. Because once you've done that, you've put the skill set a little bit further out of reach, which increases your value. And it keeps us relevant, you know, and it keeps us on our toes, and it gives us something to look forward to every month, that this day we can just go out and create and see what works and learn. And that's so important in photography.
Yeah, that's beautiful. It's also quite nerve-wracking, I think, if you've shot a certain style and you show it to a new client and they're like, oh yeah, we want that, but then for our business. And it's like, oh, I'm not sure if I can do it again. It was such a lucky shot. I've had that happen before where people are pointing at all the work and saying, oh, I want that. We want that exact style. Okay, I'll try to recreate it.
Like a challenge. Yep.
Yes, exactly. So, Laura, I guess in today's chat, you and I probably have the most similar work in documentary style. But can you maybe tell the listeners, but also I'm very curious how you approach stories, because I'm figuring maybe it's quite similar, but maybe it's actually not. So, if you can elaborate, and then afterwards I will tell how I kind of approach stories. And then we'll see how much it lines up.
Sure. I'm sure there'll be some similarities there. But because of the way I work, I've really discovered that I produce the work that's really true to my vision and really closest to my heart when I'm doing work that's sort of self-generated. Whereas when I do assignments and commissions, I feel like this self-induced pressure that I have to create in order to meet some kind of agenda for that publication. It's never a pressure that they put on me, but it's always self-induced. So I've really tried to liberate myself of putting that pressure by coming up with my own ideas and creating them and then trying to sell them. So it's almost like an opposite way of how a lot of people work. So in that sense, my stories are always self-generated. It's really about finding a particular story or a theme that I feel like I have something to say about it. This is all that it really needs. I feel like I have something deep within me. It's triggered something. And I feel like I want to say something about this. And I'm already seeing some kind of visual approaches and maybe even images in my head. Whether they materialize in the end or not doesn't matter. But I'm already seeing something in my head. And I think what's also really important is that while I always work on themes that are quite related to the social and environmental sort of world and changes that we're seeing around this, they're always also really pertaining to some kind of personal element related to my background, my family history. So in that sense, there's always like a parallel with my stories. It's personal, but it's also quite general. And I think that's all it really takes. And then I just find ways of going there and making it happen, whether it's getting a grant or, you know, saving money from other work that I do, and really going to that spot and just starting to create the images and talking to people. And I always go and like begin by interviewing people and talking to them. And then I create the images at the end, particularly if it's a portrait. And I think that makes a really big difference for me in sort of how the outcome of the portrait comes out. But that's basically a summary of how I work, really.
And from the interviews that you do with people, do you also write? Do you write your own text?
I generally do write the interviews, because oftentimes if I'm working in a country where I don't speak the language, I'm working also with a translator. Hmm. So it's kind of like a two-layered interview, and I'm writing everything. I'm doing it because it's important for me to have their words, because I want to have their voice in the story as well. Like, I don't want it just to be my visuals, because my visuals can be quite impressionistic, and I don't want that language to overtake the fact that I'm looking at a really serious social and environmental issue that's impacting people's lives. So for me, having people's words is very important, but also having the interview first allows me to really listen to them and then sort of build an idea of what kind of portrait I want to capture of them.
Hmm.
And that's really important also for me in the way I work.
Yeah. And just curious, do you show people the portraits before you publish them, or is it up to you? Yeah, you'd rather not show them, or?
No, I'm always open, especially with digital technology. It's very easy to do that. I'm always open to show people their pictures, but I'm sure maybe this will resonate with you, but most people never really like seeing their pictures. So exactly. I always get a reaction where I don't like it. So I always ask them, and if they want to see it, I'm more than happy to see it. And I show them all the versions and we kind of talk about it. But also with the work I do, the portraits are not usually very glamorous portraits. They're quite heavy portraits that are deeply emotional, because we're talking about difficult issues. So it's just a different way of portraiture, I guess.
Yeah. While listening to you, I realized that our ways are quite similar, but I think I took a bit of a detour to get to this way of working. I was doing a lot of assignment work for many years, and then I was doing my own self-generated projects. I would do them in between the assignments, but of course there was never enough time to work on the longer themed projects because the assignments also took up time. So now, currently, for the last couple of years, I'm really trying to get do less assignments and work on projects more, because it's so much easier to work on stories that you're interested yourself, you know, that really touch your heart in a different way. And I've always done that, but always try to combine it with other work, and I want to do a bit less of that. But I'm the same way. Before I go into to do a shoot, if it's a portrait or a long-term documentary story, I really like to sit down with the people first and write everything down and get to know them. I always feel so awkward when I arrive with my camera, because I always bring it on the first meeting. I always bring my camera, but I always feel too weird to kind of take it out of the bag. it just feels a bit invasive. So I love to sit down and chat and go for walks and after a while take out the camera.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
It's weird, right? When you're like, hi, then you put your camera on the table and it's like, I'm here to photograph you. It just feels a bit, yeah, it's much better to just sit down. I always tell students as well, because they, one of the questions that always comes up with students is like, how do you win the trust and how do you get these pictures? And I always tell them to keep their cameras in the back until you and they feel comfortable enough to start this process, because it's a process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also shows the people you're photographing that you're there to listen to them first as well. You just want to get to know them, and there's an opportunity for them to ask you questions as well and get to know you. So I think, you know, there's never a balance fully in what we do, but I think this brings things to as close a balance as we could potentially get.
Yeah, totally agree. And I also really like, when doing documentary photography, I really like that the people that I'm photographing can ask me anything as well, because otherwise there's really no balance. It's very important. I always tell them, you can ask me anything, and I'm very willing to share my own experience on certain subjects that I'm photographing them about, you know? So James, you as a portrait photographer, have you ever done any documentary photography, like kind of the kind that Helen, Laura and I do?
No, not on that level, but I've certainly dabbled and put my toe in the water, shall we say. I think one of the projects I covered most recently, I think, is I tried to document a wrestling show from beginning to end and sort of timestamp every image from the moment that the ring crew arrived to put up the ring to the moment that they actually take it down. It's the ring crew that arrive first and leave last, a bit like a photographer at a wedding, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yes, yeah, so, and just trying to look at different points during the day and not doing the portraits and not doing the ring side of the action. But actually what I noticed was that it became more of a study of the fans and the fans' reaction to a show. So typically when you're at a show like that, you're charted with, you know, your cameras pointed at the ring and the action and the reactions. Whereas in this instance, I was actually able to concentrate on the fans and their interactions, not only with the people in the ring, but also their interactions with each other, which gave it quite a different approach. I think I lent myself into that because I like my favorite shots in sport, and particularly in football and things like that with big crowds, is always the reaction of the crowd. I love that. And one of my favorite images is of Michael Jordan shooting like a winning point in the NBA, and he's just hit the shot, and it's from behind, and you just see this mass of fans behind him, and all the different reactions, because they're the fans who are cheering for the other team. So as Jordan hits the shot, yeah, you just see all this dismay and anger and hate and all this sort of stuff, and just this one little kid in the crowd wearing a Chicago Bulls vest, like cheering, and it's just such a wonderful, wonderful shot. So I love stuff like that. So I tried to sort of lean into that a little bit when I sort of did my documentary to try and focus on the fans, really.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's right. It's usually where the magic kind of happens, not where the subject is. So in this case, the sportsman or woman, but it's the crowd, right? It's so, I love those kind of shots, actually.
Exactly. So like the show, any show is put on for fans, isn't it? So while the action is there to be photographed, to be showcased, actually, if you're providing a product for fans, their reactions, I think, are just as integral to it, really.
Mm. Yep, I agree. So with your portraits, the ones that I'm looking at, I would, by the way, advise everyone to look at your Instagram account, because I really scrolled all the way down just to see, because there's such a huge diversity or variety, I must say, in your images. I'm like, how does he do this? How is he making that? But also, and that's what I was kind of talking about with Laura as well, how do you put these people at ease? Because they are in some quite interesting poses sometimes, and
I was really leaning in heavily to what Laura was saying, because it is about building a relationship, it is about building trust, you know, and what you said, Ovi, about bringing a camera up and people often, people's reaction to it is to turn away or is to be to just stop sometimes, you know, particularly when if you're shooting a wedding, for example. I'll notice every time I bring my camera up to my face, people will just stop. So it's all about trust, and it's all about building that rapport. And we have a really stringent process in our studio work that all our clients go through this process. They all have a face-to-face Zoom conversation, and we speak to all of the adults that are involved. It's no good just speaking to mum. I need to speak to dad as well. And the little things as well that we do in studios that we have, this is just a silly little thing, but everyone remarks on it. On the way into the studio, we have a sign on the door that's in the shape of one of those clapperboards that they use in Hollywood movies. And on it's got, we put the date of the shoot, the name of the photographers, and the name of the family who are coming to see us, and any newborn babies and any kids' names go on there with their ages. And we draw it on in chalk, and every client that comes to see us stops, looks at it, takes a picture of it, and immediately goes on their social media. So not only have we made them feel welcome, like it's a bespoke personal experience, which is what we're trying to do, but it's instant marketing for us as well, because everyone's seeing and everyone knows where they've been, you know. And it's just such a silly little thing to make it, but it just says today's VIP is, and they're in, you know. And then and I'm sure Helen will allude to this as well, the majority of my sessions, certainly the majority of the beginning of my sessions, is sitting down talking. We make sure our chairs are comfortable, we make sure the temperature's right, we make sure that it's that teas and coffees are ready for them, and then it's just a case of just talking to them and getting to know them, particularly with young families and families who've got young children. Both my wife and I, who run the studio, we've both been through that, you know. We both have young children, we both know what it's like. So it's easy to, when people bring children along, it's an easy conversation starter. And so again, you're just building layer upon layer upon layer of trust, so that when it does come to the point where we put the camera up and we're taking a photo, there isn't that sort of reaction, really. You know, it's all about trust.
I wondered with, that's to both you and Helen, who is more difficult to kind of put at ease? Is it the kids or the parents?
I would say probably the parents. Well, it depends on the age of the kids. It's funny because I start my shoots in people's homes. So I rock up at their homes usually at about 8 o'clock in the morning. So very occasionally everyone is ready, but most of the time they're finishing breakfast, someone's still in the shower, the kids are covered in food. And so it's a very relaxed start. And sometimes I'll sort of, you know, they'll open the door and a small child will grab my arm and be like, come and play in my bedroom. And I'll be like, oh, I haven't even said hi to your parents who I've never met. But, you know, and other times kids will be a bit wary. But I tend to make friends with the kids first, because if you've made friends with the kids, the parents will be happy.
Yeah.
And then worry about the parents. So I'm sort of straight down to children's levels. I'm crouched down, I'm sort of, you know, asking them, oh, those are fantastic dinosaur pajamas, oh, is that your dinosaur, what's your dinosaur's name, you know, straight in with conversations with the little ones while sort of waving at the parents and saying yes, I'd love a cup of coffee, and then going in. And one of the nice things about working in people's homes is there are clues everywhere as to what your areas of connection are. So you can look around someone's kitchen, you see the books they've got on the shelves, the pictures they've got on the walls, you know, they might have a bike, and there's always something that you can start a conversation about, even if it's, you know, how long have you lived here, great area, oh, I lived in this, you know. It's sort of, so you're, it's easy to make connections, and then people start to relax. But there are, and one of the funny things about starting in people's homes and getting the trust with the kids is it's amazing how often the parents will be like, all right, we're just going to go off and do that, and you're like, no, don't leave me in a room with two small children in high chairs, because they will lose it, because you've always got to keep a parent between you and the kids until the kids come to you, and they always will come.
Yeah,
but it's got to be on their terms, because if a toddler or baby crawls over and kind of climbs on your head while you're taking a picture, you know they trust you. But if you go between them and their parents, it's like, oh, this is a bit of a threat, I don't know how to deal with it, and that can derail it. So it's very much kind of working to get the kids' trust, and then the parents' trust comes, I find, very quickly when they see how relaxed their kids are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And would you agree, James? Is this the same?
Oh, God. Absolutely. Everything rings true. I mean, I always think, like, the kids are so in charge of everything. They're in charge of how much the parents are enjoying it. And, like, I'll often, like, you've got to check your ego at the door with these family shoots as well. Like, so I'll often get things wrong. Like, I'll call someone's brother their sister and their sister their brother, especially when they're sort of like 4 or 3 years old, because they'll know the difference and they'll think that I'm the stupid one for getting it wrong. But then that gives the power control over to the kids. They're not intimidated by you, which means that they sort of like, they, you know, they're easier to get those natural expressions from. And that's what you're trying to get ultimately. If I'm in a studio situation with a family and I'm getting anyone to say cheese, I've not done my job properly. I've not worked it enough. You need to be in that situation where they're natural and naturally reacting. And that's when you start taking those portraits into a documentary style, you know, which is more appealing.
Well, this is for any of you. I'm trying to think, actually, the question is if there was ever a shoot that started out tough, but one that you kind of managed to turn around. And I'm really trying to think if I've ever had that. I'm sure I have. To any three of you, is anything jumping to your mind?
I always have one that rings true with me. I mean, I find generally, because I'm photographing people in their homes, favourite people, parents and kids, they're in their favourite people, they're with their favourite places, you know, so they tend to be good. But if they don't, there's usually a reason, you know. Kids coming down with something, parents are really hungover. But the worst I've ever had was with a regular client. So I knew them very well. They arrive at 8 a.m, the parents are looking a bit haggard, and the kids were just being terrible. I mean, they're really nice kids and they were just behaving so badly. And it's like 10, 15 minutes into the shoot, I say to the parents, like, what on earth is going on? This is very out of character. And they'd flown back from the States the night before. Their plane had been delayed. They'd got home at kind of 2:30 a.m. and I'd rocked up at 8 a.m. expecting a photo shoot with 3 small kids. And obviously that wasn't going to happen. So in that situation, I knew them well. I was like, well, you all go back to bed. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to watch a couple of movies. Let's get up in like 4 or 5 hours. We'll have a barbecue. I traveled quite a long way, so we couldn't just kick it to a different day. And then we did the shoot in the afternoon and it worked really well. And I find with my kind of work, most things can be cured with a nap or a chocolate biscuit, but you do have to be quite flexible. But yeah, that was definitely the worst of the starting bad, but ended up being one of my best shoots of that year.
Yeah, because that also created a, I don't know, that you gave them that extra time to sleep kind of created something between you as well, I guess. So this is a question for all three of you. What are kind of, what would you say are the similarities between documentary photography and portraiture? I do a lot less portraiture than you do, Laura. So maybe you are the right one to kind of start.
I find this a difficult question, actually, because I don't know. I've never actually thought about this before, but I guess off the top of my head, I'd say the similarity is that I see myself as somebody that is documenting people and like people's stories. So there's definitely an intersection there. I think the only difference is that a portraiture is often an image of in isolation of usually one individual. I usually don't do multiple portraits of multiple people. I find that really difficult. And I'm really interested in creating an image, a portrait where the viewer is looking eye to eye with the person in the image, particularly when looking at issues like, you know, climate change and the environment, things that oftentimes we haven't really seen the full impact of what they've done. So in creating images of people who have stories, who have actually seen these changes to them, like farming communities, it's important for me to create that dialogue between the viewer and the person in the image to show them this is a real story and this is somebody that's really been impacted by it. So I think the intersection is that they're people's stories. I think they're both, you know, of course, I'm directing a portrait, but as much as I can, I also look for these moments between the moment when their eyes look somewhere that I haven't told them to look. And that becomes an image that I take, because for me, that's as close to documentary within that portrait as I can get. And I think the differences, again, is, you know, in one situation, you're more in control, whereas the other one, you know, you're much less in control of what's happening around you.
Yeah, totally, totally agree. I feel as well, I mean, there's, of course, two types of portraiture. You have the setup portrait, of course, within documentary photography, but also the environmental portrait, which to me is always a bit of a vague term. But I would say if I'm photographing someone, let's say a farmer working at the farm, I also see that as a portrait. even though this person is not posing. I really love environmental portraits, but I do realize when a newspaper sends me out on assignment and they ask for a portrait, that is not necessarily what they meant. They usually mean someone looking into the camera, or at least, yeah, posing in some way. But to be honest, my favorite kind of portraiture to shoot myself is environmental portraits, because it tells so much about the person, kind of who they are, what they do. And to be very honest, it's also easier for me to take those kind of portraits compared to the ones that are more posed. Coming back to the same thing I mentioned before, for me, it's quite difficult to direct people. I should really do that more. I always feel a bit, I don't know, every portrait I'm taking, it kind of feels like I'm doing it for the first time, even though I've taken so many already.
Yeah, I should also say that with portraits, one of the things that makes them a little bit more sort of accessible or comfortable in a way for me, although I'm never comfortable doing a portrait, but is that I never work with lights, because I don't know how to use lights. I don't know how to use flash. So I really prefer to work with natural light and find these pockets of light that work within what I'm trying to say, which is, so I think that also relates to, like, for me, the intersection between how I work with documentary and portraiture. For me, the light is very important.
And Helen or James?
Sorry, I just wanted to go back because I wanted to tell you a story about when a shoot went wrong. But I will come on to the documentary question in just a moment. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's perfect. Please.
Sorry. No, I got kicked out of my studio once at the beginning of a shoot. So I was on location in Camden photographing a show, and three big burly wrestlers came in a very, very small room and kicked me out of my studio and said, "We're using this as a changing room because there's no other space for us to change." Right. This was supposed to be my studio where I'm taking like all the promo pictures, just a plain black background. I thought, well, what do I do? And I'm like, well, I'm in Camden. And I looked outside and there's all these graffitied walls everywhere on this street. And there's the underground station. And I thought, well, I'm just going to shoot outside. So we did all these. We took the wrestlers outside before their matches and after their matches, put them in front of graffitied walls, took them down the tube station, did a few shots down there. One of the wrestlers, who's got his big beard and sunglasses, found a shopping trolley and starts running up the street with it. And he puts another wrestler who looks like a surfer in it. And it's one of my favorite pictures of them wheeling each other around on the streets. Just bizarre stuff. And it changed the way I approach those shoots forever. I never shot the same way backstage ever again. I never took a backdrop with me because it's a pain to take on the underground anyway, but I never took a backdrop with me. I just took one light, my camera, traveled light, and just shot whatever was there, whatever wall was there, I was going to shoot against that. So it changed it forever, which is a massive benefit. In terms of the documentary to portraits, I haven't really got much more to add than what Laura said. I think she put it so eloquently and so brilliantly. I think documentary is like, actually getting this question really made me think about it, and I'd never thought about it before. And I do think portrait is a way of documenting. It's a form of documentary. And then documentary of people is a form of portraits as well. But I think ultimately the documentary side of thing is the story is driving it. So the story is driving the camera and the photographer and all of the elements. And with portraits, they always say, like, portraits are essentially a picture of two people. They're a picture of the subject and a picture of the photographer. And depending on what you see and the way that you take it in that, you can often find that some of the strongest portraits are actually reflections of the photographers themselves. But I'll defer to Helen. Sorry, I feel I took over then.
I know, that was a really good answer. Like, oh, what can I say now? It's a really interesting question, this. And I do slightly feel that sort of the differentiation between documentary photography and portraiture in social photography, by which I'd mean wedding and portraits, is quite different to pure documentary. Because I know, you know, in news photography, there are very strict rules on what is and isn't allowed in terms of interaction or adjustment within a scene. Whereas often with sort of, I don't know whether he'll agree or disagree, but within sort of family portraiture, documentary family portraiture is generally people don't want to spend all their time in a lineup standing still. They want things to be a bit more natural. They want more interaction. But there aren't any sort of specific rules. So, you know, I'm trying to keep things as natural as possible. I'm sort of going with the flow. I'm following the games. But equally, you know, if I'm in the park and there's a really distracting person in the background of one of my pictures, I'm going to Photoshop that out and I'm not going to worry about it. Whereas in a news situation, that would obviously be a real no-no. So I do think it is slightly different in within the different genres. But yeah, I think if I was trying to define it, I'd be thinking of documentary photography as having less interaction and portraiture having a bit more. But certainly for me, working on these private commissions for families, I'm sort of flitting from one to the other and back again all the time and not really worrying too much about the sort of specific wording and differentiation between the shots. It's all, in my work, it's all just sort of family portraits.
Yeah. And I also think for clients, especially for families who might not have, you know, like a special extra knowledge about photography, to them, it's just most important what the family will look like
exactly.
In the end, right? Not if it's a documentary or a portrait.
Did they have a good
to them,
time?
It's just like, okay.
And do they look good?
Exactly. Yes, 100%. That's the main, well, that's with all of our work, I guess. The main thing is the outcome. What does it look like? It doesn't really matter what it is or what it's named. So for me as well, I know there is a difference between documentary and portraiture, of course, but when I make a story and when I work on a long-term story, I also, I don't think about, oh, this was a portrait or this... Yeah, it just goes, I just make a selection of the images and I send it to the editor, basically. That's, or I make a book or an exhibition. And I don't really, in my mind, divide the two kinds of, different working ways. Shall we move to the Canon EOS R system? I know that people who have been listening to the podcast probably already know that I'm a big fan, but I'm very curious to know, first of all, which cameras you're shooting on. Helen, what are you shooting on?
So I'm shooting on two EOS R5s now. I shoot with two cameras and usually with prime lenses. So my sort of standard kit bag would be 35, 50, and then either the 85 or the 100mm macro. I do have a 24 to 70 if I think I might need something wider or if I'm shooting somewhere where I want to be a little bit less conspicuous and just go with one camera and one lens. And also like the little RF 16mm too. And I've got 100 to 500 if I think there's going to be, you know, boats or horses or something where I want a little bit more distance. But usually I'd be 35, 85 or 35, 50 with the two R5s.
Yeah. Yeah. That's quite similar to my kids. So, James, what are you using?
So I'm currently shooting on the R6. I've got an adapter, so it fits to all my old lenses. But about 8 months ago, upgraded to, basically changed them all to RF lenses. I shoot, my workhorse is my 24-105. It's the one I sort of take on every shoot. And I've just found the change so slick. It's been... it's been revolutionary in terms of the way that we work in studio and on location as well.
And Laura?
Yeah, I have an R5 and I think I have about four lenses. My go-to lens, like James, is the 24-105. That's the one I usually use all the time. And I have a 200, an 85, and I have a macro lens of some sort. I often forget what lenses I have just because I usually have the same lenses all the time. So I don't really remember, but I'm pretty sure this is the setup I have right now.
So I'm also using an R5 and I have the adapter. So I'm using the lenses that I already had. And the main lenses that I use, and it's been like that for quite a while. I know maybe it's the same for you, but I sometimes get stuck in kind of using the same lenses. And then I'll make a switch all of a sudden to something new and get stuck again. And then I switch again. So that's the story of my life. But so I use the 35 and the 50 and the 24-70. Those are my kind of go-to. But now listening to you, I'm wondering if I should switch to the 24, what was it? 24-105, is it?
105, yeah.
Maybe that's better. Yeah, because the one lens I do want to get is the 85 for portraits. But if you have a 105, I guess the 85 part is kind of covered by that as well, of course. Yeah, I'm quite liking the fact that I actually have the adapter so I can keep using the lenses that I already had, because it's of course quite an investment to switch, and I'll probably make the switch at one stage, but I mean everything is so sharp and the adapter ring is, I mean, it's perfect. It just works. So for me for now, this really does work. So why did you all make the upgrade to the ELSR system? And was it a big change for you?
I think for me, I was on the Mark III before that. So for me, it was definitely a big change. The R5 is much smaller, much lighter. I love also, as I was making this transition more into video, I think the R5 just seems to work more naturally in the way that it's set up. I find that now I'm thinking much less about how to go to the next step to switch things on my camera midway as I'm shooting something. And it just all comes very naturally. So I think the way that it's now been designed is just more closer to the way that I think. And it even allows you to set up the menus in a way that's easier for you. So yeah, I find that now I can just really focus more on what I'm seeing and much less on like what's happening within the camera and how can I quickly do these changes to make it happen.
Yeah, I totally agree. Totally agree. And Helen?
So I took a bit of a time to swap over. So I was lucky enough to use the EOS R before its launch back in, 2018. And that was a camera I didn't want to give back. And because it was just such a different way of working. So as soon as that was launched, I got one of those. But it wasn't quite everything I needed. So I shot with an EOS R alongside two 1DX Mark IIs for a couple of years. So I had the 1DX Mark IIs for the sort of the movement and the speed and the sort of they were, you know, they're so well built if I was on the beach and sand and all that kind of thing. But then I found the EOS R I was using more and more if I was inside, just because it's so flexible. You know, you've got that screen you can use, you had the sort of the tracking and it was a very different camera to use. So I used them together for a while. And then when the EOS R 5 came out, again, I used that for a couple of weeks, Canon lent it to me. And then I was like, right, this is it. I'm going to sell all my kit and I'm going to get two of those and swap across some lenses. And it's been, I couldn't go back. I don't think it's such an, as Laura says, it's such an instinctive camera to use. And there's so much that helps us as photographers be inventive and creative and playful. I mean, for me, the EVF viewfinder has been an absolute game changer because I work entirely in monochrome. I have my camera set up so that my viewfinder is in monochrome, and I find that makes my life really much easier. You know, I can see how the tones and the light are changing much more as I'm working, and it's allowed me to be just sort of bolder, faster, because, you know how it's going to look but actually being able to see it just means you can sort of work a bit faster, work a bit more instinctively, have a bit more of your brain to be on interaction without worrying about things. And so I've found it a fantastic camera to use.
And sorry, stupid question from my side. If you're shooting in monochrome, then the file is monochrome, right? Or you're just seeing it on the back of the screen in monochrome?
So it's, I don't know quite what the technical, so it's still in RAW. So it pops out and you open it in Photo Mechanic and it's all in monochrome, which is great for culling. So you're doing all your culling and it's all in monochrome. When you put it into Lightroom, it then kind of pops back into color, but then it's just, a very quick, batch, put it all back into monochrome. But I find because I do my culling in Photo Mechanic, I'm doing all that in monochrome and it just makes it very, very fast.
Yeah, I see. Oh, I didn't know it worked that way.
It's really good.
Yeah, that actually sounds great. Well, I don't work that much in monochrome, but I can imagine when you're looking at the either the viewfinder or the back screen, that it's much easier to kind of see what you're going to get, what the end result will be.
Exactly. And the sort of the graphics of an image are much easier to sort of see in that way. You don't get distracted by, there's a big red bin in the background in the park or something. It's very helpful.
Yeah, I can imagine. And James?
I upgraded, and I use the word upgrade deliberately, I upgraded during the pandemic because I'd like baked enough banana bread to feed a small army and I just needed something. So I kind of went along and thought, do you know what? I'm going to get this and just see if I can change. Because I'd always flirted with mirrorless in the past, but there'd always been a downside.
Yeah.
Like a small delay on the shutter, or the focus wasn't quite good enough, or the file size wasn't quite good enough. And I was never fully convinced. And I took it on, and as everyone else has said, it's so intuitive. And I remember the first studio shoot I did after playing with it. We got some clients in for a day, got them, you know, a load of families in, and the last family in bought a miniature Schnauzer dog, and I was loving the autofocus on this camera.
Yes.
And particularly with the RF lenses, it is quick and pin sharp. I've never seen anything like it. And they bring in this Schnauzer, and I go, oh, I'll just have a mess about with the settings, see if I can change something. I went to face detection, and lo and behold, in the face detection menu, you can choose whether the Canon detects people or animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's their face detection. And this was amazing. So when I wanted the dog to be in focus, I could get that every time. But also to share, I remember I was so excited by this. I shared the information with the clients at the time. I don't know whether that was a professional thing to do or not. I've just discovered this thing on my new camera. But they were amazed by it as well, which sort of, I guess, puts the level above.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I've not looked back, and I'm in the process now of, I mean, I love my 5D Mark III. I just love it so much, and I don't want to sell it, but I think I'm gonna, and because it's taken me to so many different places, and I've always had that one on my hip, but this R6 and everything I've shot with it since has just taken everything to the next level, and it's really allowed me to fully unleash my creativity, I think. So yeah, I think everything else is going to go. I think I'm fully moving over.
Yeah, I recognize, yeah, what you're saying, and also what Helen and Laura were saying. And once you've made the switch, I switched because I actually was lucky enough to do like a test shoot for Canon with the R6. And then later on also with the R5 actually. And I remember when using the R6, the first thing I thought was, wow, it's so lightweight, which for me is really a big plus because I already carry quite a lot of lenses and stuff around. And while traveling, it's also nice to have a lightweight set, of course. And then I had to give it back to Canon, sadly. And then I tested the R5, and yeah, I definitely, like Helen said, didn't want to give it back. And it's been such a journey in a way for me. I even started changing the whole way I shoot in the first few months of working with the R5. I was, for instance, only looking at the screen in the back. I was constantly shooting through, like, just looking at the screen instead of looking through the viewfinder. I now slowly am making the switch back to the viewfinder, or I'm doing it, yeah, both now. But it just changed the way I was shooting. I could kind of shoot from the hip because the focus would always be on the eyes. I love that about it. The fact that you can just walk around and think, hey, that might be an interesting shot, and you point the camera and it just focuses on the eye of a person. It's, I don't know, I'm amazed by it. I mean, I still have my 5D Mark IV, which I love. And James, I recognize what you're saying as well. That camera has been everywhere with me for many years, and I love it. And it's, yeah, I still use it now because I like working with two cameras. So I'm using one R5 and one 5D Mark IV. But they're just really different systems, I feel. You can't really compare them. And with documentary photography, of course, the silent shutter is also lovely. Well, I guess for any kind of photography. Yeah, I'm in love with this camera. So who did just mention the custom menu? It was you, Laura, right?
Yeah, I think I mentioned that. It's something I actually discovered a bit like a few months after getting the camera. I was looking online at some of the, I never read a manual, so obviously I usually discover things late. So I was looking at some videos online and discovered you can actually customize the menu and do all these things. And it really changed it for me, because then it became very instinctive for me where to click without having to look, just as I continued looking through the viewfinder to kind of change the settings. So yeah, I love that. It just gives you so much freedom and flexibility. And yeah, it definitely has changed, like, you know, in terms of creativity. It's definitely just allowed me to focus more on the visuals I'm creating, and not really have to have any hangups about the technical aspects.
Yeah, I recognize that as well. And even though photography came natural in the last 15 years, you know, like more natural every day, I would say. Still, sometimes while working, you were just worried about settings. But now, because you can see what the picture will look like in the viewfinder or on the screen, that already gives me so much, like ease of mind. It just shows you like this is what you're doing, and it either looks good or not, but you know it right away. I love that about that. And yeah, I'm like you, by the way. I never read the manual, so I only figured out the custom menu quite recently, and I didn't even figure it out myself. Someone from Canon showed me in the Netherlands. He was like, oh, you're not using the custom menu? And now I'm all about the custom menu. I have everything set up in there that I use often, and I love it.
Yeah,
and did any of you, like I said, when I was talking about the lenses, I have the adapter, and I might move to the new range of lenses. Who has not moved to the new lenses?
I'm working between it, but I'm now 90% on the new lens range.
Okay. And was it any factor in your decision to make the change to mirrorless to not move because of a whole new set of lenses?
Yeah, if you forget an adapter on a shoot and you need it and then none of your lenses fit, that's obviously a problem. But I think the main deciding factor was how lightweight the RF lenses are, and therefore when I'm shooting video, which I'm getting asked more and more to do, and the R6, the video that comes out of it is sublime, particularly when we're shooting at like 100 frames per second. We're getting a lot of good slow motion stuff. We're diversifying into weddings and into other forms of brand advertising with that sort of video. Because often clients, especially corporate clients, will ask us for photos and then always tack on at the end, or do you do video too?
Yes.
And you can. But with the RF lenses being so lightweight, my gimbal can now like really take it.
And the
battery doesn't drain on it, and you can use it all day, and it's so reliable. And again, because these new lenses, these RF lenses, are just like with the face tracking, as you say, Ovi, with the you point it at a subject, you just go straight to the eye.
Yeah.
Even in video mode, that's still the case.
Yeah.
So like we shot a branding shoot yesterday for a client who just wanted new fashion images for his Instagram profile, and we were able to increase the quote by adding reels to his quote. Oh. And just by flipping the camera around 90 degrees and shooting at 100 frames per second with him walking down the street, you've got about 10 reels that you know have increased the value of your quote, but also increased the service that you're providing to your customer. So that's the main reason why we're going fully over to the RF lenses now, just to balance on that gimbal and give us better quality video.
Oh wow, that's amazing. I didn't even think of that. About the, yeah, I know they're lighter, but the gimbal part,
I did when my gimbal died on me 10 minutes into a shoot because it was too heavy and the lens was too far forward. I suddenly thought, oh, how can I rectify this? And there is only one solution, really, ideally.
Yeah, you found the solution now. And Helen?
I started with the adapter, but now I'm pretty much all across. I did the thing where I sold two 1DX Mark IIs and 14L series lenses in one go, and got not nearly as much money as I'd paid for them, but swapped across. I think it's one of those things, once you've used the RF lenses, particularly the L series ones, just the quality is just, it's just mind blowing. I mean, the 50mm 1.2, which is my desert island lens, just the quality out of that lens is fantastic. But I do like the fact that they're bringing out the kind of the two levels of lenses, because I've actually got both the 50 1.2 and the 50 1.8, because I'm greedy. And also because the RF 1.8 is so small, so light. So if I'm going out with mates, or if I'm going to the hub or some kind of, you know, and I want to take a camera and I want a prime lens, but I don't want to take £2,500 worth of 1.2 beautiful glass, I can take a small one. And it's a great one to recommend to clients, because a lot of my clients are very keen photographers. I'm like, you know, get yourself like get yourself into the mirrorless thing and get that RF 1.8, because it's so cheap. It's at £200 and it's such excellent quality.
Yeah.
And it's really something phenomenal, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing. I know those smaller lenses, the lightweight ones, the 50, but I think there's
the 35,
also, yeah,
the
35,
macro.
Right? Ooh, exactly. Yeah,
love it.
There are amazing lenses, and they're so light that you think, I wonder if this will work. And it's just mesmerizing how quickly they focus. And But to be honest, I've heard a lot about that 51.2 as well, because when I'm shooting, I don't do that much news anymore. But sometimes I'm at a shoot and there's many other photojournalist colleagues, and so many have bought that lens and everyone keeps talking about it.
Don't try it until you plan to buy it, because you won't be able to not buy it. It's so
good. That's what everyone tells. They're like, oh no, just try it on my, they'll like unscrew their lens and give it to me to try it. And I'm like, no. it's amazing lens. Everyone keeps telling me. So I'll probably make the switch as well. For now, I'm happy with the adapter, but I can imagine, just having a full set of new lenses is always nice as well.
I've got a fully boxed macro lens at home, RF lens that I bought, that I haven't taken out of its box yet because I'm too scared.
Why?
Because I think if I start using it and shooting it, I'll get obsessed with it, just like we do with any new piece of kit. So I'm a little bit. And now Helen isn't actually putting my worries at any ease at all by saying how brilliant all these macro lenses are.
Go with it. You'll have a brilliant time.
And James, I know you also make use of a lot of in-camera techniques. I'm curious to know which ones.
The basis of my camera sort of obsession, I suppose, came. I surround myself with fellow photographers, and particularly at like end of year awards dues and things like that. I do a lot more listening than I do talking, and I hear it gets louder every year. Photographers saying that the only images that win are now ones that have hours and hours of Photoshop work done to them. Over stylized, over processed images are the ones that constantly win. So I set myself the goal last year of trying to win with a raw image. I wanted to win any sort of category, any sort of trophy with a completely raw image. And last year at the societies here in the UK with an awards due in London, they have a category called in camera artistry, where you have to submit raw images with no processing, and they award a winner from that. So I just use some high speed flash techniques in studio, and it's one of our takeover shoots again where we get creative for a day. We basically bought like 5 bags of plain flour, a bucket of silver body paint. We used about 2 lights on it, and we basically painted our model silver, placed them on a grey backdrop, and then chucked flour at him. For an afternoon, and tried to capture images at about sort of 4,000th, 8,000th of a second to try and get everything frozen. And we got lucky. We got the shot that we wanted, and which was basically making him look like he was exploding out of chalk. But because he was painted, the image looked like a black and white image. So when we submitted the raw, it stood out because all of the other images in the category, looked colourful and another one looked different, and made you look twice as to how it was actually achieved in camera. And that image not only won its category, but it went on to win the whole awards night. First place in over 6,500 images, which I'm still, so it was basically me turning around to the industry and saying, look, okay, Photoshop has its place, and I always say that a good image can be made great in Photoshop. Photoshop can't make a bad image good. And ultimately, what we do with photography is we're trying to tell stories, we're trying to draw with light, and we're trying to get people who view images to make their own assumptions and their own conclusions about what an image means. And ultimately, storytelling and what you see through the lens is key to that. And to prove that you could do it, you could win something with something that, with just the tools you're given, just the body, the lens, and the light. And I think that all comes from just us experimenting in studio and trying new techniques, because only by trying new techniques do you really push yourself. You set yourself up, you always face the risk of failure. And sometimes that's what holds people back, is the risk of failure and the fear of failure. And if we have one shoot every month where we don't fear failure, where we do just go for it, and if it doesn't turn out, no one loses anything except time, then you can, push yourselves to different limits. So that was the story behind that, really.
That's beautiful. Well, I really believe that experimenting like this, like we said in the beginning already, is something that I did much more of in the beginning years. And you're right, the only thing you lose is time. And that's fine, right? You can just try these kind of new things. I think for now, for me, it's actually a good time to do that now, now that I started using the whole new camera system, because it's already such an experiment for me. I remember doing the first shoots with this camera. I was so nervous, thinking, oh, it's going to be a whole different way of working. And it really was. And it's funny, you see a big difference between the images I took, let's say, 2 years ago and that I'm taking now. So I already feel I'm quite kind of experimenting. I have the whole, it's a different way of working for me altogether. So I guess by the time I get used to working with the R system and maybe making the switch to the lenses, maybe it's time again to really do some experimenting and paint someone silver and throw flour at them.
It's fun. It's a fun. Yeah. It's not fun cleaning it up, I'll tell you that much.
I can imagine. So do any of you look to the other genres of photography? Do you kind of look at the genres for inspiration? I do this a lot with portraiture, actually. I have a lot of photography books. Most of them are documentary photography books, but I love looking at the portraits because that's the one part that I want to learn from. So now, after having this chat together, do you kind of feel, that you want to be inspired by different genres or maybe totally different genres like sports photography or something else? Let's start with Laura.
Well, I think there's actually a lot of intersection in what all of us do here today. I think it's just like the way we approach it is perhaps just quite different. But I think there's an aspect of documentary to each one of us. I do look at photography in general, but I have to say in the last few years, I've been sort of self-editing and not really looking at as much photography as I used to, maybe like, 8 or 10 years ago. I don't know why that is, to be honest. I think it was maybe just a way to protect my own personal vision and kind of try to nurture it without having any other work psychologically seep into the way that I see things. But I think also part of it was because I think oftentimes we get so sheltered into what we do as photographers and we just feel like, there's nothing else to look at. And I just want to look at influences maybe from elsewhere, like film and music and cinema and theater and, just life in general. But I do look at photography and I don't really pay attention to what genre it particularly pertains to, just as long as the image sort of captures me in one way or another. I think there's definitely a lot to learn from it. Certainly, I've learned a lot today from what James and Helen have had to share.
Hmm. Oh, beautiful. And James?
I allude to what Laura said, actually, trying to look outside of photography for inspiration. Anytime I'm in London, I'll always check out like the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square because it's free. But secondly, it's so big. You can't really do it in a day. And you can just go back through history and any era, sort of see these gargantuan paintings with so much effort and detail and stories, and also the YouTube channel for the National Gallery has all of the stories behind each painting, so you understand what the Heywayne's about and what the influences are behind it and the stories about how they tried to get those works exhibited and back in the day. I think one of my favorite Twitter accounts, actually, not that I'm on Twitter that much at all, is one called One Perfect Shot, which is basically a list of perfect shots from movies. So they'll take a still image from a movie and you can see the cinematography, the use of color, the use of composition, and how those, because essentially I think the most stylistically best movies are a sequence of beautiful photographs, with a beautiful story. And when you see something that you like, then you can find that movie out and you can really involve yourself in it, just really do a deep dive into it, settle down and enjoy some wonderful videography. But in between that is all of the uses of color, all of the use of composition throughout to really sort of inspire you to take your photography to another level. So I would agree with Laura, try and look look outside of, I try and look outside of photography and especially my genre of photography for other influences.
Hmm. Yeah. That's actually some solid advice. I think the same, I kind of go back to the start of our conversation where I said I was experimenting more in the beginning. If I'm very honest, I think I was also looking at more broader genres in the beginning. So into more into film, and that Twitter account sounds amazing, by the way. That sounds like something. What was it called again?
One Perfect Shot. O-N-E, One Perfect Shot. Yeah. So have a look through that. But I found some just, there was a brilliant still on there from a movie called Eighth Grade, which is, I think, the best movie I've seen in the last 10 years, directed and produced by Bo Burnham, who produced the Netflix special Inside. And Inside is his own self-documentary filmed through the pandemic, filmed by himself, lit by himself, produced by himself, Inside on Netflix. I first watched that and I wanted to give up creating anything ever again. Because I thought, I haven't shown an ounce of the creativity that this man has got in his little finger. I mean, I just haven't. But then I watched it, and I refused to watch it again. And I watched it back because one of my kids really, really likes one of the songs in it. And I watched it back the other week with my wife, and we both sat down and we said, no, this isn't something to hold us back. This is something to be completely inspired by. And it's so beautiful. And yeah, just open yourself up to trying new things. Don't go on streaming services and just go to the recommended things, because they're trying to get you to see things that you've already seen that you already know that you like. Try something different that you don't know you like, you know, because you might find something that you've never seen before.
Yeah,
I'm so sorry.
It's so true. No, that's beautiful. I love that. And Helen.
Actually, I'm slightly the other way. I'm drawn to still images more than moving images. So while I do look at films and stuff, I'm much more likely to be found with a book in sort of all forms. So I look at particularly a lot of landscape photography. I really like landscape photography and I like to do that as well. And I like to incorporate the environment into my portrait work. So sort of having an idea of the sort of history of landscape photography, I find really interesting. But at the moment, I'm getting most of my photographic inspiration from sports photography.
Oh.
Particularly, you know, there's been so much sport going on recently, and I have no interest in sport whatsoever. Like, I'm really, really not interested in it, but I love the imagery and the sort of the technical expertise of the sports photographers. And what I like to do is sort of look at something, and, you know, they've got some England goalkeeper saving something, and I'm like, that's an amazing shot, you know, that Eddie or, you know, Mark or one of the other Cannes ambassadors might have taken. And I'm like, how do I take something similar with a two-year-old with
yes.
their first football?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I'll be kind of, I find the imagery is stuff that I can kind of directly borrow from, but also it's completely different. So it's not a sort of copying thing, because obviously, you know, what you can do at the Commonwealth Games compared to what you can do in a back garden with a four-year-old is very different. But just I think sports photographers have an extraordinary creativity in something that they're in no way influencing. And I find that really interesting as something that I can take into my work and just sort of trying to mix up the types of pictures that I'm producing for my clients. So I look at a lot of other photography.
Yeah. I totally agree on the sports photography. I did the episode a couple of weeks ago on sports photography, and I'm so mesmerized by those kind of images. I always think, how do they do this?
Yeah, how? And it just happens once in that millisecond. I can't go, come on, Jemima, can you do that again?
My heart rate would be so high constantly if I would be a sports photographer. It's so good that I'm not, but I'm so amazed by what they can do, and it is an inspiration to actually to my work as well. I've looked a lot at sports photography in recent years. So last question to you guys, kind of as a wrap up, and I'm curious to know what you're gonna say, but if you would have to trade jobs, like within each other's jobs, if you would have to trade jobs with each other, just for a day, not for your whole career. But what do you think you would learn from the experience? And, well, who would you trade with?
Well, I'd love to actually trade with Helen, because I follow her on Instagram and I love the pictures that she posts of the families that she photographs. And obviously hearing her speak today kind of gave some insight in how she does that. But I constantly struggle with taking pictures of my own family. And I think they often wonder if I'm really a photographer for a living, because the worst pictures I take are the ones I take of my own family, because they're always just really not relaxed and not really themselves. So I'd really love to be Helen for a day to take some pictures of my family that really show who they are and just show them, you know, loving life, which I think Helen does really well.
Well, I think that sounds like a deal. I'm going to come and photograph your family. That works
Please
for me.
Please do. Please do, Helen.
I was thinking, it's such a hard question, isn't it? Because I was thinking I'd say sort of Laura or Ilvi, just because James and I work in the same bit of the industry, although our approaches are so different, we are sort of within the same bit. And you both are in such different bits. And I was thinking about it yesterday, because I love how Laura's work looks at people and their place in the world, but also with that much broader social context. And I'm loving the sort of the visual connections between the people in her projects and the photographic techniques and sort of abstract nature of things. I find really fascinating, particularly all the long exposure work, which I really enjoy. But then, Ilvi, I love your sort of long-term projects, because I've never done anything like that. And I was looking at your website and seeing the cream cakes and paper chains, which is 100 people celebrating their birthdays. And I just thought that was just fantastic. You know, I might photograph one particular family on their birthdays, but then to go out and make that such a wider thing and then bring it together in one, I thought was just absolutely inspiring. So but, you know, I know, obviously, I'd learn a lot from James too. I mean, I don't know how to use a flash, so that would be a good starting point.
And James?
Yeah, no, I'm going to sit on the fence. I'm not picking anyone. I think from Helen, I'd learn how to take a family photo that everyone can enjoy, because I'm always so focused on family photography so that the mum and the dad enjoy it. But she has a real crossover appeal so that anyone who's a parent can look at any one of her family photos and get an emotion from it and get a feeling that's intrinsic to their own family. And I think that's a real skill, to take something like that. And with Laura, I think she does herself down. I think to have the bravery to go back to Egypt and to start a project with returning to her family. Because I can't photograph, like, my kids I can photograph, but anyone who's older than me and my family, I still feel like, you know, the 7-year-old kid who got a Darth Vader outfit on Christmas Day and ran around the house in a Darth Vader mask. I don't feel like a grown up in my own family, and I feel awkward trying to, even just talking about it now, I feel awkward about approaching my own family. Like, to take a photograph of my own mother, I don't think I'm brave enough to do that. So and I think also what Laura does is, like, she has the bravery to use her skill to talk about social and political, you know, issues. And I still don't really understand really, like, what my position in the world with that is. And I'm certainly not brave enough to put it on canvas or to put it out to the world. So I think ultimately that's what I'd learned from both of them, really.
Yeah, that's really, really beautiful. I have a difficulty picking myself like who I would trade with, because I think there would be a lot to learn from all three of you. But I definitely do know that the thing that I know less or the least about is using flash and using lights. I would be ashamed to share on this podcast how little I know about that. So James, I think I would switch with you and trade with you for a day just to try it all out. I've started using more lights in recent years. So I'm learning by doing, which usually is the best way, I guess. But yeah, I would love to trade with you, because if I look at your images, I just don't even know how you take them. So I would love to sit down and
nor
for
do
a
I,
day
so we can
and
both
be your
work
shadow.
It out.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks so much, guys, for this really open conversation about photography and the ELSR system. And it was really lovely having you. It's always a bit difficult to have a conversation when you're with four or three. But I really love this one because you're all sharing so much. It was really lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Ilvi.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much to our guests for their time on the podcast today and for such an interesting chat. And we'll be back again soon with another episode. Until then, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can rate and subscribe in the episode's listing. If you have any thoughts or feedback on today's episode or the podcast as a whole, why not reach out to us on social media? You'll find our details in the description below. We'd love to hear from you.